I wanted to use diversity to make it a global platform. And because we're home to so many different embassies and we have resources to designers around the world, it was our goal to be the Olympics of Fashion Week. We had to give a reason, why would you do DC versus New York? Or why would you do DC in addition to New York? If you're already doing the world's biggest, we had to sell a different dream. And our dream was to get your country behind you. And that's important to a lot of like, if even if it's just the ambassadors there or the cultural attachés there or one of the leading publications that's associated with their country mentions their brand, that's really huge for them.
I'm Brandon Vaidyanathan, and this is Beauty at Work, a podcast about how beauty shapes our world and the work that we do. In this season, we're looking at beauty in science. This episode is sponsored by Templeton Religion Trust and the Institute for Advanced Catholic Studies at the University of Southern California. More about them later in the show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome. I'm so thrilled to have my guest here today, Mr. Ian Williams. He's a former National Security Agency intelligence analyst in the United States Air Force and a professional model and actor with America's Most Wanted, A Man Called Hawk, and Anacostia. He's also a multi-award-winning event producer and fashion designer of two labels, Magnum Underwear and Corjor International, using his two oldest sons' names, Corey and Jordan. He's also the founder and executive director of DC Fashion Week, a nonprofit organization, and the fifth largest growing fashion week in the United States, with 39 seasons under its belt. Ian, it's such a pleasure to have you. Thank you for joining us on the podcast.
Good afternoon, Brandon. I'm happy to be here.
Great. You had a great introduction to the power of fashion when you were a child that I think helped draw you into this career. Could you tell us a little bit about how fashion became important to you even early on?
Well, for me as a child, it was just a matter of we were taught to just match. And back at this time, there was a brand by Sears that were like Geranimals. Even when I would go in and shop with my parents, I knew if I matched the alligator with the alligator, it was a good fit, or the hippo with the hippo. So I learned early with matching clothes and colors and things like that. And I was pretty much just kept that going. It wasn't until I inherited some stepsisters who were older and a little more fashionable, and they gave me some choices. And what was the biggest impact was the difference that people responded to. And this was in junior high school. We call it junior high school. I know you all call it middle school now. And I couldn't get over all the commotion and attention that a change of clothes, you know, the effect that it had. And I had to admit, as a teenager who was, you know, nerdy, I liked it, you know, and I wanted to continue that. I captured attention of, you know, the popular girls in school that normally wouldn't have not said anything to me for the most part. And they all commented. And I was like, wow, clothes. I didn't probably put it in these words, but I saw the impact of how dressing affected, even from my teachers to my classmates and just in general. So I saw that impact.
That's great. Where did you grow up? And was fashion an important part of your family? Was that something that you mentioned your sisters, but was that something that was considered important in your household as you were growing up?
I don't know if they stressed the importance of fashion, but my mother was very fashionable. She liked to dress up. She was a self-professed beauty queen. So she liked to walk in a room and make a statement. So that was always her thing. My father was very cool. I remember specifically in, you know, during that time period when I was like 7 or 8, some of the clothes that he wore, you know, were flashy, and there were popular TV shows we were watching. We could relate to it. So I know he took pride in what he wore when he went out, you know, for special occasions, but day to day, he didn't care at all. It would be embarrassing coming to school.
I can relate to that. I think my parents didn't have any kind of fashion sense, and I found it very, very embarrassing when I'd have,
Like my parents, I'm like, oh, please tell me he wore, you know, something decent.
A shirt that's not torn.
Fortunately, both my parents were very attractive. my father, all the teachers would always comment on, he looked like Billy Dee Williams, and no, is your mom around? You know, and things like that. So it didn't matter what he wore. He had a lot of swag.
Okay. Great. What did you want to do when you were a kid? And then what was your trajectory going into college? And what was it that you were trying to pursue?
It was basically, I started off wanting to be a doctor. You know, we were all taught, you know, at a very young age, the most prestigious jobs were doctors and lawyers and things like that. I never wanted to be a policeman or a fireman or those things. My father worked really hard. He was a plumber. He knew how to fix it. He had auto mechanics in his background. He self-taught with all that. He was always fixing people's cars and rebuilding projects and things like that. And I knew early on I didn't want to do that. And I was very condescending about it. He would remind me that this is what pays the bills and gives us a good lifestyle. And don't turn your nose up at hard work. Mm-hmm. And I remember one time saying to him, he said, I'm going to teach you how to change a flat tire. And I said, well, why would I need to learn how to do that? He said, because you may have a flat tire. I said, I'm going to call somebody to come and fix the flat tire. And he hated that. He wanted to break that spirit in me because I didn't want to do those things. So I patiently sat there and, you know, watched how to do it. But yeah, definitely medical school. My freshman year in college, I got a engineering scholarship, but I was still going to just do medical. But after one semester of that, I went to the guidance counselor because I wanted to be a psychiatrist.
Okay.
And I'm going to tell you what was so funny about it. This is an old reference. It was very, very popular show at the time. It was called MASH. Are you familiar with it? So one of the characters would wear women's clothing because he was trying to be, say that something was wrong with him. So he would go in and sit on the psychiatrist's sofa. And somehow the hourly rate came out. And I was like, oh, man, that is good. You can get $100-something an hour and let somebody sit on the couch and tell you their problems. Like, I want that job. But after one semester and I saw that it was going to take like at least like 14 years, I told my guidance counselor, I said, I want to get out of here in four. What degree pays the most graduating? And at that time, it was computer engineer. So I immediately switched.
Okay. But you also worked in modeling for a bit, right? Was that before you went to college or?
Yes, in high school, because by then I had gotten a reputation for being fashionable. And there was some regional contest between all the high schools for fashion. And I was nominated and I won. Then I did a local fashion show. I enjoyed that. I was really known for my runway walk. It was different. So I did enjoy that. But it was heavily discouraged. My father's like, that's not what young men do. Let's get you focused on something else. He didn't want me distracted with that. So he was not a fan. Not a fan at all.
Okay. But you did well. I mean, you were successful.
I did well. And then I went into the military because, again, I was paying for school myself. My parents definitely believe that you won't miss class. You'll value better when it's out of your money.
Yeah.
And they saw this with many of their friends, how they were very nonchalant about their education. So he said, if you're serious, this is what you'll do. We're not going to mortgage the house for you to go in and chase women all day. So that was important. So then the military just offered a good option. I could get my degree. I could travel the world. They would pay for my college. I would get some training. So on paper, it just sounds like a wonderful idea. So that's the next route I went.
What was it like in the military? You were in Italy? Was that like?
I was in Italy. I was in Air Force Intelligence, That was pretty cool. Top 2% of the military. So, you know, I've always had an elitist personality growing up. They actually sent me to the psychiatrist in the military. and the complaint was, like, I didn't live in a realistic world. Like, my expectations were not. They didn't. Based on my background, they could not understand the confidence I had and just how I perceive things. Okay. So our TIs are very, they're very intimidating, but I knew going in, they couldn't hit you. Mm-hmm. They could yell at you. I knew that was to be expected. So it didn't bother me. Now, had I been, if you equated to like going to jail and it's scared straight, that would be different. So that's how they try to liken it to like really get you in line. But when you know that they're saying cliche things like, what are you looking at? And you say nothing. Who are you calling nothing? I mean, it's just, I had heard it all before. So yeah, they had an issue with me.
Okay. Wow. All right. So you went 2 years in the armed services and.
No, I did four years. Day one, I knew I was going to be 4 years and done. I knew I wasn't going to, you know, be a life or anything like that. I utilized all the benefits, which were to buy a house with no money down, get a degree. Mm-hmm. I only got 2 years degree while I was in the military because the schedule was very challenging, rotating hours and not a normal 9 to 5. Right. So it was really difficult going to school and being full time in the military. Mm-hmm. It took me 10 years to get a 4-year degree. Just to say it short, 10 years.
Wow. Well, talk about your journey into the fashion world. And I mean, what was your experience of the modeling world like? And was that something that you wanted to come back to later on and be part of that?
It was just fascinating to me. Now, granted, at this time period, we didn't have social media. Hmm. We only had magazines. There weren't a lot of publications of models that looked like me. So therefore, it was always like, could I do it? You know, uh-huh. I wanted to always fantasize about it. So my first exposure were like live fashion shows. And every fashion show I would go to, I would get booked. I came back to D.C. After doing a 2-year stint. I modeled while I was over in Italy because I was considered exotic.
Okay.
And now I know how that works in the modeling world everywhere.
Say more about that, like what works, yeah.
Well, so if you go to any place where 90% of the people look like they could be siblings, and then you have another 10%, everyone views that as exotic. Mm. So let's say that you're in a community where everyone has dark hair and dark eyes, because most of the world has brown eyes. So when you have that pigment change, that seems more exotic. Then you have people who have naturally lighter, blonder hair, then that seems exotic. But if you go to other places around the world where 8% of people have blue eyes in, you know, blonde hair, then maybe red hair is considered exotic, maybe a dark brunette. So I've learned early on that if you're not like the norm, you can be exotic and then you can do well in that fashion community because they want everybody wants something different. It took me a long time to get that.
Okay. Okay. Did you have a positive experience when you were modeling, or were there challenges that you had to face?
Oh, most of the experiences are not positive in comparison. So for like every home run, you know, you strike out about 20 or 30 times. Okay. And it's difficult. So I try to, as a director, to be very sensitive to the mental health of model talent. Because we live in a different world. And it's the only career field, I compare it to dating all the time, which is, you know, not a good comparison. But I put it in this sense. As a gentleman, if you go out and you ask someone to date, and out on a date or to dance, I remember in high school, I asked people to dance. And, you know, sometimes she said yes, sometimes she says no. So when she says no and you're walking back across the gym floor, you feel a certain type of way. So in modeling, that happens. And it always comes down to you don't have the look that they want. And it's almost impossible not to take that personal. Mm-hmm. So even today, I did a fashion show last night and I saw disappointment on models coming in. Like one particular model, she's short. And he said, someone said you were looking for a short model. I said, I don't know how anyone could have thought I said that because I would never say I was looking for a short model. And then I realized how they came out. So I said, I had a short dress, but I don't have short models. So, and she was very, you know, I could see she was disappointed and, you know, they get excited, you know, they get excited about one, they'll model for you, which I consider an honor, you know, but, I have an aesthetic that I want for my brand. And I pretty much sticks to it in terms of the type of models I want, the type of look I want. And that's important. And that's important to all designers. You know, it's not a sympathy thing. It's about marketing, branding.
Yeah.
So the same skill set, if you're hiring an engineer, they need to have this skill set, these programming skills or be familiar with these applications, you need that. So if you don't have those things, it's not as disappointing. You may still want the job, but it's disappointing. But when it's based on your appearance, you know, you're too short, you're too tall, you're too skinny, you're too fat, or all those things, that's really hard on a model. And I get that. So we try to be delicate in our responses.
Yeah, because you can't change those things about yourself. You can't grow a few inches or, you know, so. But for yourself, I mean, when you were in the modeling industry, I mean, could you talk about things that maybe challenges that you faced or ways in which you learned to become resilient or practices that you developed there that helped you?
Well, I didn't do it the practical way. Like most people, you know, got some training, which I definitely value. They get some professional photos, which I didn't start off with. You don't need them, but all these are assets if you have them. If you can already show the client what you could look like, that's beneficial. But for some, they have the skill set to just look at a fresh face, no makeup, plain clothing, and realize that this person has supermodel potential. But it's easier to convey when you see them dressed like a supermodel and all glammed up, and they can show some variety. So that will always trump the basic Polaroid shot.
Yeah. Yeah. How did you, I mean, with your experiences of like, I mean, you mentioned sort of dealing with rejections. Was that something that was difficult for you to learn how to do, or were you able to do that pretty easily, or how was your experience?
It was hard. It was hard initially because you're not having the right look. You don't know what that means. Like, are you not tall enough? Are you not light enough? Are you not dark enough? You're not ethnic enough. You know, it was a different time. I remember going on a casting call and they wanted me to change my vernacular. And I read the script and they were like, okay, now go in here. And he goes, I want you to be really, really black. And I'm like, what does that mean? Because I found it very condescending.
Yeah.
And he was going in through the language. It was like very stereotypical, whatever casting or whatever. And I said, well, what time period is it? Because that's not what that community, that's not how they talk. I'm as an authority, that's not regular dialogue, you know, in any community. It's just not. So I remember that being difficult. Like you're trying to tell the director what to do and correct his. That didn't go over well with my agent, but sometimes you have to give them, you know, direction because sometimes they don't know. And it's not a bias thing. It's just what they've not been exposed to it. That's the difference.
Yeah. You
know? But it's hard. Rejection is hard. And when a lot of it is based on physical appearance, that really, really hurts, you know, because there's nothing you can do about it. You know, but, you know, and that's what you hear. No, it was a no, it was a no. So you hear a lot more no's than yes. So one, it does build character and confidence. So when you do land something, you feel really, really good about it. You really can celebrate, but you learn from it because sometimes you can ask for feedback to see what is it is there anything I could have done different? And then if the answer to that is no, then you know you're not the person for that job. And you have to live with that. You have to be okay. I'm not the person. Yeah. And same thing if you're in the dating world, as I compare to dating, sometimes you're just not the other person's type. You know, they may want a bad boy. They may want this. They may want that. And if you're not that type, you're just not that type. And you have to be okay with that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. How did you get into designing? Was that something you did as a kid?
I had no aspiration to design at all. So most of my problems in the fashion industry have been just from an engineering background. When you have a problem, you look for a solution. So when I was modeling, I wanted to model, you know, in a bigger platform. So I started teaching at a modeling school that had the parent company Elite that would come in and do the scouting once a year. So that's why I did that, you know, and then training also helps you with your skill set. For doing a fashion show, I was working with designers and I had a designer kind of put me against the wall with demands at the very last minute. And I had to give in and I hated that. I hated that I had to do that. So then I started designing some stuff. So I was, well, at least I will have a designer in case it doesn't work out with others. And I worked really, really hard on it. And as a result, in terms of career wise, I have surpassed all of those designers. Now they come back and they all remember back in the day where we were starting off. So that was the only reason for that. Creating Fashion Week, there was an opportunity for the designers in DC to have a platform to introduce themselves to the fashion community because there wasn't one here. So then I created Fashion Week to do that. So everything was always a result of seeing a problem and then trying to find a resolution for it. And then it moves you to the next step.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Well, talk about your brands. I mean, you have, you know, Magnum and Corridor. Talk about why those two brands, how they came about and what they do, and what's your sort of creative vision for both of those?
Well, I first started off with Courjure, which was named after my kids, Corey and Jordan. And we tell Ryan, you know, once he came around, the third one, that he was the last part of it, right? So he says all three, but it's Corey and Jordan. And I started off as a menswear designer. I love smoking jackets. I watched I Love Lucy, and Ricky would come home and put a smoking jacket on. And I just imagined that just felt rich. You know, I was always intrigued with old shows like Dallas and Dynasty that showed wealth, because when you grow up watching Bewitched and Gilligan's Island and I Dream of Jeannie, you know, Brady Bunch, none of those shows had opulence and lavish lifestyles. So when you had these other platforms that had that, you're like, wow, this is what the other part of the world lives. And it's captivating. You know, we're definitely pop culture is captivated by it. So that drew a lot of inspiration in terms of I wanted people to feel that way in my clothes. Mm-hmm. So I did men's loungewear for a while with smoking jackets, lounging pants, and things like that. It didn't sell well. So that was a little frustrating, but people like seeing it. They love seeing the models in it, you know, and all that, but it still has to make financial sense.
Yeah.
So what the game changer was, I did a big show with 40 pieces and I did one female dress and it wasn't even complete. And after the show, all of the reporters and media that came to the event all said, we must see the dress. And I remember being so heated about it, you know, because that was not the vision. Uh-huh. But going forward, I continue to make women's work. And that has been the most influential. I'm published in publications around the world. I get special invites to other prestigious platforms because of my work with women's wear. So, you know, I came around.
Okay. Wow. That's quite a surprise. And I'm glad that worked out. What about Magnum? How did that come about and why?
So this young lady in Georgetown, I remember going to her store and I was telling her what I did. And she was telling me that, you know, when I told her my price points were, she go, that's good, but you have to have something that's of a lower price point. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to understand why. So in her example, she says, my low price points are postcards. And because back then people bought postcards. You know, can we imagine that? When last time you bought a postcard? They bought postcards. And she said, pantyhose. So she goes, she sells enough pantyhose to pay her telephone bill or something else and enough postcards. So she says she makes sure that every person comes in, if they don't buy a gown, they buy something and it adds up. So since I wasn't selling wedding dresses and evening gowns every day, I needed a lower price point in a different direction. So first it was all about sensationalism. I didn't use the traditional underwear models where they would look all flat in the front and like the basic old Calvin Klein that you see in the newspaper. I took these big hunky bodies because I knew that women were the primary buyers for their husbands and boyfriends or sons' underwear. So I had to put an aesthetic that made them look. And that was a success for Calvin Klein. He pretty much put that model out there. And it took off. It was an explosion. The units were flying off. I would go to the post office. Oh, there's the underwear man. Which I hate that process. I hate mailing stuff. But yeah, it was pretty much like the bread and butter for a period of time.
Okay. Okay. Great. Great. I want to ask you, a few questions about beauty, which is it a word that some people associate with fashion? What does that word mean to you when you think of the work you're doing, the work you've done? What does beauty mean in your world?
I think I look in the context of what its goal is supposed to be. So let's first deal with just the normal. Let's go from your earliest exposure to beauty is as a parent and you have a child and this baby comes out, they really looks like an alien. They all do. They all look like an alien. But so much time and care has gone into bringing this life. And on a day-to-day basis, as your baby is changing and cooing and all these things, you see this beautiful alien, you know, in your arms. So it changes. And everyone thinks they have the most beautiful child. They look at it and they see a reflection of themselves. And it's a piece of beauty. So that's the first exposure to beauty. I think it's great. Of course, you have superficial beauty. You know, there's nothing real about it. It is all glammed up and like artificial, but there'll always be a place for that. There'll always be a place for it. You look at some people who, you know, engage in plastic surgery and they have really altered their natural look to where it's not really a cute aesthetic, but they continue to do it. And it's because they have a false perception of what their self beauty should be. And I feel sorry for them. I really do, because they're destroying themselves. You can see beauty in everything if you look for it. You know, you can see beauty in poison ivy, a daffodil, the sunset. You know, you just through the smog, it is where you are. So Beauty has a lot of different qualities. This is a matter of just how you look at it.
Yeah, yeah. Tell me about, like, in relation to the purpose of your work, right, and the vision that you have. Particularly for DC Fashion Week, but even for your brands, would you see beauty in the purpose or behind why you do what you do?
No, I wouldn't say that, because beauty has many different definitions. So what through one person's, one photographer's lenses, what they may view as beautiful, the rest of the world, or even the majority of the world may not.
Yeah.
But fashion can sell anything. They can take what most people may have been exposed to in their childhood and as adults that they would never view as beautiful, but because fashion has embraced it and marketed in such a way that it's beautiful. And there's examples of people with skin discolorations or gap teeth.
Yeah.
Features that we normally would, if we had an option, we would suggest fixing them. If we had the money and the resources to do it, but fashion can present it in such a way that it becomes exotic and is viewed as beautiful. And then other people want to do it. There are some people who have actually had perfectly straight teeth and chiseled them to make them have a gap.
Yeah. 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 No, I think there's some cultures where that's really,
that's crazy.
Yeah. 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 Yeah, yeah.
The fashion world can distort your reality as well. But I mean, if you go along with it and it works out for you, then by all means, you know, go for it. For example, most people that would view a beauty mark now, you know, Marilyn Monroe made it popular, but it was a little dot. It wasn't a mold like Cindy Crawford. It took fashion to make her exotic, where then other women who had imperfections on their face, they started to get work because she had laid down the foundation for it. So it changed the world's perception of what is beautiful. But I'm sure as a kid, she probably was ridiculed for it. And before her, it wasn't deemed to be a beautiful quality, if that makes sense.
She's
one of the most beautiful women in the world now, and it's fashion has sold us the vision on that.
No, that's an interesting point, because I think certainly once you have somebody who's out there as a recognized model, they do shape other people's perceptions of what's beautiful. I was curious though in my question in relation to, like, when you set out to start DC Fashion Week, did you have a vision for what would make this event really beautiful, in the sense of what would make this really worth doing? What, you know, even when you continue to do it, do you have a vision for how you would execute this in a way that you might be proud of, or that where its impact could be, you know, something that people could judge as beautiful somehow?
I saw how demographics were important. Although I lived in Maryland, I knew that there was more power in creating a DC Fashion Week than, for me, a Baltimore or one of the major cities around, or in Virginia, you know, Pentagon City Fashion Week or those things. I knew that because of geography in D.C. that would have more impact. Mm-hmm. We always started with saying that I wanted to use diversity to make it a global platform. And because we're home to so many different embassies and we have resources to designers around the world, it was our goal to be the Olympics of Fashion Week. We had to give a reason why would you do D.C. versus New York, or why would you do DC in addition to New York? If you're already doing the world's biggest, we had to sell a different dream. And our dream was to get your country behind you. And that's important to a lot of, like, if even if just the ambassadors there or the cultural attachés there, or one of the leading publications that's associated with their country mentions their brand, that's really huge for them. Particularly when we were dealing with countries that geography is not my strong point. It still isn't. I had never heard of Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan. I had never heard of those places. And when we had designers come in from there and they would do really well and they would pick models, and we thought they would pick mainstream models because they were coming over from Europe, and they were like, no, we want this because we have models that look like this every day. We want something different. And that was surprising because when you look at, when you go to the shelves and you look at all the major publications, you see one form of beauty, at least during that time period. Today is much, it's never been a better time for diversity in the fashion world. You know, they have finally caught up and they show it in a beautiful way. You see everything now versus 10 years ago, that was clearly not the case. So they made a lot of progress.
Yeah. So that was really important to you to sort of highlight diversity and to make that possible. Because I recall you'd taken attempts to include modest fashion, for instance, as that was not something popular elsewhere. But
and that was different because, again, fortunately, I had an organization come to me representing modesty because, of course, I've seen the attire before, but I didn't know that it was modesty wear. And that probably come from where I encourage people now today to get a history of fashion and to study. You know, I didn't do that. So I'm a very, 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 very bad example because a lot of things you really learn that are insightful that help you.
Yeah.
And I just kind of was fortunate to be at the right place at the right time and stumble across it. And when we were interested in modesty, it was a very sensitive time because we had just had 9/11. And I remember some of the parents expressing their concerns, like, you know, are you worried that, you know, in their ignorance, you know, that, you know, we're going to be the victims of terrorists now because of if these people are here, if they go, these people are here. And I was like, that's not the case, you know. So it was embraced really, really well. It was different. And we did it for a number of seasons. We were the first. We heard later New York Fashion Week, they announced that they were the first fashion week in the U.S. to have it. But we had them like 4 years. Like I like repost. I would post their comment and comment up under it. Yeah. Like this happened 4 years ago.
Yeah, that's great.
You're listening to Beauty at Work. This episode of the podcast is sponsored by Templeton Religion Trust as part of a grant on the aesthetic dimensions of science. Templeton Religion Trust supports projects as well as storytelling related to projects that seek to enrich the conversation about religion. To learn more about them, visit templetonreligiontrust.org. This episode is also sponsored by the Institute for Advanced Catholic Studies, a global research center located at the University of Southern California. IACS works to create dialogue, spark ideas, and sustain academic research on Catholic thought, creative imagination, and lived experience. Learn more at iacs.usc.edu. If you're enjoying the show so far, please subscribe to our podcast and take a moment to leave us a review.
Talk about the process, right, that goes behind creating something like a fashion week. And is it super stressful or do you see any beauty in that process too?
It is super stressful because there are a lot of moving parts to any production. Mm-hmm. And a lot of things can go wrong in a live production. So you have to be well prepared for that. There's always the fear of someone tripping or a breast popping out or pants not fitting, or there's always, you know, a live reaction. That's always a fear, no matter how well you are prepared for that. So that's part of it. The other part is getting, you know, the right players involved and in the seats. Because, you know, we want press. We want they want to get exposure for the brand and get feedback. We want influencers. You know, influencers, you know, I used to frown on them back in the day. But as the world changes, you have to change and be adaptable to it as well. You know, because now we all recognize the importance and impact that influencers have, you know. So that's important. So, yeah, it's stressful in terms of wanting to get everything right. Everybody else wants everything right. And then you're dealing with the creative community, and they all have big personalities. Uh-huh. It's very rare you come across a super humble, quiet spirit. That doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. They're all Jeff Gordon designers. I sometimes say that. Because they want it perfect as well. And my team tells me that I'm the worst of all of them.
Oh, really?
I said, but I'm organized. But it's because, as they say, because of your organization and your OCD, it's almost impossible because it's just too much. Just relax and trust your team. But it's like too much. So we joke about it always afterwards. We really do. But I think it makes them stronger employee, and if they can handle me, they can handle anyone else in the industry.
What is your team like? I mean, do you enjoy working with them? Do you see sort of again, if you use the word beauty, do you see beauty in that collaboration with the folks you're working with?
They love fashion, which is good because you can't do it for a paycheck. You know, you can't do it for a paycheck. And you're more passionate about something that you enjoy doing and be a part of the process. Then I don't have to micromanage because it's your work ethic, it's what you want to contribute to the process and what you want to see happen. That's different than someone having to do something and, you know, having it, what's it, be a bean counter and count, you know, jelly beans or whatever, you know, there's something that's monotonous. So they all enjoy being part of the creative process. That is great. And we're literally like family. Like after the, you know, take her out for dinner, we go to each other's events, whether it be somebody's, you know, baby shower or wedding, or they're getting an award for something. So we're very supportive of each other in that. And that's great. They're clearly all they're considered as family and friends.
That's great. That's great. When you say they love fashion, what about fashion do they love? Like, is it the ability to change the way people feel, or like what about it is worth loving?
I think they're drawn to the fashion world and the excitement that comes to it. You know, there's something about the clicking cameras, the beautiful models, the fashion, the responses, all being part of the production in that process. That's exciting. Mm-hmm. It's still exciting to this day.
Okay.
So that part. And then they all have backgrounds. Like three or four of my members were models and expressed an interest in learning how to do more and were able to, you know, be promoted and become team members. But that's sometimes a challenge because this last season was the first time I implemented that no staff members could model. Either you're staff or you're a model. I don't want the lines to cross over. And that was hard for some people.
Why is that? What was the reason behind that for you?
I think that when you are working with the models, you're getting, you all are, I mean, because models, there is a click. So you're clicking with the models. Then when you have to be in a position of authority, it's hard for the models to make that adjustment because you were just, you know, laughing it up and, you know, with them a moment ago. And now you're telling them what they can do and what they cannot do.
Yeah.
And that doesn't always transfer well.
Right.
So I think they lose the respect of their position because they are of that association. So it's important that there's a difference between production, management, and models for me.
So
one person decided that they rather model than be on the team, which, you know, hurt my feelings for a moment. But I realized that the designers really love them and they have a different aesthetic and it's exciting for them. So I get it.
Awesome. What is your vision or your hope going forward for DC Fashion Week? Do you have a dream for what you would like to see this become?
I do. The last Fashion Week was the absolute best, hands down. It was fantastic. We were able to do a lot more because we had some generous sponsors come on board. Mm-hmm. For most of the seasons, I've always been self-financed. And we'll get some sponsorships, but a lot of donations in kind and things like that. And every now and then, you know, a big corporation like, you know, T-Mobile or Coca-Cola will come in and do something, but they were not consistent. And of course, we're gracious from whether you give $200 or, you know, $50,000. We're gracious for all of it. But it's good when it's $50,000 because we can do a lot more. But because of that, we're able to give a lot. We are the highest return on the designer's investment. Like we're the lowest priced major fashion week in the world. You can go around and check the other sites and see what they charge for registration, number of looks, and they're 5 times, 10 times higher than what we do. So we're a nonprofit. Our goal is not to get it that way. It was to, and then we have the public income versus just buyers and press. You know, the public can come and experience it as well. And we think that's helpful. We think that part is helpful. And it helps cover some of the overall costs. So that's where we differ. But going forward, of course, we're going to have more community partners. Eventually, I do want it to look like an Olympics. I want the world's best designers from each country to show their work at Fashion Week. And that's a huge effort to try to do, but I think it's something that's doable.
Yeah.
I look forward to it. I really do.
That's a beautiful vision. What led you to make it a nonprofit?
Well, I knew that as myself, I didn't have the resources available for Fashion Week as a designer for me. I mean, I did the calls. It was six figures when I first started trying to show it with other major platforms. Mm. And I couldn't have gotten my then wife to ever agree to anything like that. So I knew there had to be other designers in the same position. And I felt that as a nonprofit, we can negotiate lower prices on everything because our vision is different. Like, our reason why we don't do this is because we're trying to help. We want to help designers, we want to help models, graphic designers, publications. We're here to help as a platform. So we were one of the first Fashion Weeks to do that. There have been several others that have embarked on the same thing. And the hope was eventually to get charitable donations to people who like fashion as well. That was eventually the hope for that to happen. But as long as people could respect us as a nonprofit and that we had a mission, then that made the price points explainable.
Okay.
That makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. If you have any advice for folks in the modeling world or aspiring to be models, given all the challenges, given how difficult it is with rejection and so on, what advice would you have for people who are entering that domain?
I would say for them to, for one, study. So here's a part of the study process. And I tell models this all the time. There are some very popular model websites, and they do a category ranking of the top 50 female models and the top 50 male models or the top models in this particular category. I say, look and see who those people are. Look at their poses. Look at the agencies that they're associated with. Look at the work that they're trying to do. You don't have to reinvent, you know, the wheel. You can take that as inspiration and incorporate that in your own style. So do the research on that part. Like, don't try to join this particular agency if they don't have any talent that looks like you, you know, and unless there's a clear need for that. So that's part of it. Aim high, but be able to have realistic expectations. That's really important. And you have to ask yourself, if I get this job, how will I feel? If I don't get this job, how will I feel? And that's important. That's important for your mental health. And then, of course, and I tell them this is most important, to just simply be professional. That's what people remember. They remember your own time. They remember if you were kind. Yeah. You know, they remember if you listened for feedback. They remember if you smile. Leave an impression. And be kind to everyone, because you don't know who is going to make a reference. You know, if you're mean to the receptionist, as the casting director and someone else are talking, he or she may decide, like, well, do you really want that model? Or she can say, or he can say, what do you think of this model? And then it'll jar their memory and it will work in your favor. And I know that happened with me on several occasions. It's just a matter of just treating everyone with respect and kindness. That they remember. But they also remember rudeness.
So, yeah. Well, that's great. What about any advice to designers who are, again, trying to succeed? And
for designers, we all share some things in common. We all want to be famous designers. We all want to be celebrity designers. We want rich people wearing our clothes. We want to be in the best stores. I laugh when I watch some of the reality stars, when they all come out with a brand, and the first thing they say, they would have been Neiman's and Saks and all of these prestigious retail outlets for their brand that's, you know, nowhere near the aesthetic of what the brands that are in these are. So that's a delusion in itself. So be realistic about that. But say, well, who's your customer? Who's going to buy your clothes? What do you want that impact to look like? Where do you imagine your items being at? Not where you want them, but what's reasonable, where you can have them. And that will really help. That'll keep you from being disappointed. So I realized that I can use the sensationalism of Magnum underwear. I got it trademarked. And I knew what most people would think if they heard the name Magnum. And it goes to the adage of their sex sales. So I will put these very sexy models in the Magnum underwear. And then I would go to the adult novelty stores and I did brand placement in those. So at one point I was in five of them and I was moving units that way, because then they go in and there wasn't a lot of underwear. The underwear in there, a lot of people wouldn't normally buy. I put it that way. But because of the name and the branding, it did well in those stores. So that's where I aimed for. I didn't aim for Macy's, Target, or any of those things. But as of today, my first manufacturer resold my SS inventory to other places. So now it's on Amazon and Walmart of all places.
But yeah, bootlegged, right?
Bootleg. Yeah. You know, and I'm like, wow. So yeah, it's because you need to set up Google alerts for your brands and stuff. And I was like, looking at it, it's like, wow, I'm on Amazon. Wow, I'm in Walmart. How did that happen?
You're not getting any of that money.
None of the money. But they say, you know, it's a imitation is flattery. No, I don't go for that. But it is, it lets you know you reach a certain status, you know, when it happens, because they do it to the best of brands. There's fake Gucci everywhere. So they do it to the best of brands. So I have to look at it that way.
Yeah. What else are you working on? I mean, you've had such a diverse range of careers and interests. Is there any other project you're juggling on top of all of this?
I am considering going back to theater.
Oh, wow.
Just once so that my kids can see it. I haven't done television in like a super long time. So I would like for them to see that. So I was, I'm being offered a script for a play for early spring. So I'm going to consider it.
Okay.
So that's one thing. I'm going to continue to, of course, do fashion and decide what direction I'm going in for the new collection. So that's it. For Magnum, I've expanded to swimwear. It's going to be high-end swimwear, which we normally can't picture out what does that mean for men, high-end swimwear. So there is a category of men who will pay, you know, $200, $300 for a personal trunks. Most won't, but there are a group that will. So I'm catering to that particular crowd with the latest. And it's, you know, it's flashy, you know, gold and metal and all those things. So I'm going to do an editorial campaign for that. I want to work with other photographers for editorials, because it's always fun to see your work published. It helps with the branding, helps with the selling. So I'm super excited about that. And just, you know, just going forward, I'm going to take a step back on producing other fashion weeks. I did a lot of fashion events this year. As I told some of the organizers of the event last night, that this was my last fashion show this year.
Okay.
They're like, no. So yes, it's my last one this year. I'll go attend others, but I'm not showing or producing anymore. You know, unless I get a call from Oprah or something.
That's great. What fuels you? I mean, you've got, you know, I think so many different interests, but are there sort of a set of key drivers or motivators that you think are keep your energy up and keep you going?
It is seeing so many people's dreams fulfilled for them. So many from models to designers to even people who are new to, you know, journalism. And then I wrote a blog on my coverage here, and it increased my blog viewership. And I can't wait to do, as a result, I now got invited to do other things. A lot of people tell me because I did what our coverage was DC Fashion Week, we now are invited to New York Fashion Week, which of course is the Mecca. A lot of designers say that because of that, New York Fashion Week is calling me. I know they would never know who I was if we hadn't done the platform. So hearing those success stories, that is always great. We always want them to come back, though. But you know, sometimes you just go on and you go on. So we understand that as well. So that's always exciting for models to get their dreams realized. There was one model, and I told her mom, I said, you absolutely have to take her to New York. There are certain faces she look at, and like it's like 1 in 20,000 that has to look. And I'm telling you, she has to look. And her mother took her to New York. And she got signed to one of the top agencies next. So we're like super duper excited for her. We had another model, and I told her that she had the perfect look for designer Calvin Klein. And she went to New York. She got signed by a New York agency, and her first client was Calvin Klein.
Yes.
So, you know, we don't always get it right, but we're super excited when it does happen. We really are.
Yeah.
So that's the most important, gratifying part of seeing people work hard on their dreams. And we give them a platform to kind of exercise that. And they viewed it as successful, and that's great because it literally changes their lives. You know, there's nothing wrong with having a different business platform where you make the best ice cream because it gives people joy because we like ice cream. Does it impact the world? I don't know, but it gives us joy. So just how you view it. But we love seeing people have their dreams fulfilled because most they have different backgrounds. I mean, we have designers who are doctors, who are lawyers, who are professors, you know, and although they enjoy their 9-to-5, it's a different thing for them to follow their passion like that. So we get it and we find it exciting. We're happy for them.
Awesome. Awesome. Ian, thank you so much for taking the time. And this has been super insightful. Where can we direct our viewers, our listeners to your work?
Well, our main platform is, of course, dcfashionweek.org and Instagram official DC Fashion Week, Facebook DC Fashion Week. My personal is Mr. DC Fashion Week. So I'm curious to hear your vision, your view of beauty. What is beauty to you?
Oh, yeah. So I'd say for me, it operates at various levels, right? So I think there's a fundamental sort of metaphysical beauty, like everything that exists is beautiful because it's part of, you know, existence. I think that's part of this reality's attractiveness, right? Okay. The little things in space that draw us, you know, that faraway galaxies and black holes, all of those things to the tiniest sort of particles, I think have an intrinsic attractiveness. But then there's also, I think there are a number of things that are beautiful have in common. And there are things like harmony and symmetry and elegance and a sense of fit, unity, the kind of element of surprise. So whenever we call something beautiful, it typically has some of those qualities. And I'm really interested in beauty in the work that people do. So there's certainly okay. The physical beauty, right? Which you're talking about in either clothing or faces, but in, you know, in the work of a designer and seeing that there's a match between whatever they're coming up with and the person who's wearing it or the way in which something makes people feel and the way in which clothing can convey to people a sense of confidence, right? I think there's...
It can reflect your personality because we make judgments, you know, whether we do it so intently or just organically. When we first see someone, we look. And most people, if you take three people and have them walk in a room and walk right back out, and you ask them to describe the people that came in, they will almost all put the same main features down for each person. Mm. You know, and there's a scientific way of looking at a facial shape and the space between the eyes and the nose bridge and the fullness of the lip. There's a scientific way of examining what quote unquote a perfect face is that most people will respond to positively because it falls within this thing. Yeah. But then you can have someone that doesn't fall in that whatsoever at all, but because of the charming smile. Almost everyone has a beauty to them when they smile, when their faces really light up and smile. And that part is great. You know, I remember referring to a model as a boring pretty. Hmm. And they wanted to know what that meant was that was nothing wrong with her, but it was just a boring pretty. She was pretty. But there was nothing exciting about her portfolio. Yeah. So if she were to do some things differently, it would come across much more positive. It wouldn't come across as boring, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where someone else is not deemed aesthetically as attractive, but because they have excitement in their pictures and their poses and their personality, they're stunning. Mm. Yeah. You know, it's impactful. Because you can put, when it comes to marketing, you can put a particular model in something and it doesn't capture anyone's attention or anything, or you can do it a different way and it makes a big difference. I'm sure you've seen this experiment they did with Payless shoes. They put it in a very ritzy area. I think it was in New York, and you know, they put very attractive salespeople in and display, and you know, they made it exotic. You know, I remember I had this friend that could perfectly give a fake accent. I don't know what country it was, but it was an accent. But he worked in Neiman's, and because of this fake accent that he would give, it made him an authority on fashion. You know, and he sold shoes, and he used to just say how he would just sell all the. And there was one like he sells so many shoes, and he sells like the most expensive pair. And he felt that part of his delivery was his fake accent. He was like, you know, and I can't even do it. I don't know what it's somewhere between French and Ukrainian, and maybe Caribbean. It is so funny. It's so funny. Yeah. You know, he's Southern, you know, okay. So we know he was thinking wrong. So it's hilarious.
Wow. I mean, I think that's, you know, that's one of the challenges with beauty is it can be deceptive, right? You can use it to, you know, to sort of deceive people in some way, and, you know, but also the kind of unexpected aspects of beauty that you're mentioning are really important, the kind of way in which a person's personality or energy can shine through and make something not boring, right?
So what's the opposite of beauty for you then? So we've determined what we think beauty is. What's the opposite of that?
Yeah, I think it's a very broad umbrella term that I'm using. I think it has sort of a very contextual aspects to it, right? So I do think we can call things ugly in ways that are, so like, for instance, when I study scientists, you know, where they find beauty, when they talk about where they find beauty is in, you know, either the kind of phenomena they're studying, like the stars or cells, or mm-hmm. in the insight, the understanding, you know, where you have a harmony between, you know, an idea you have, a theory you have, and how reality actually turns out to be, right? And that fit, that, wow, I guessed it might be like this, but to see it's actually this way, right? That kind of fit is really beautiful, or even just uncovering the hidden order or patterns is really beautiful. And you asked about ugliness. It's always about relationships.
I didn't say ugliness.
Right.
Opposite. Yeah. Well, beauty.
Yeah. So for me, that's I'm gonna call it ugliness, because that's just the literal, you know. But I'll tell you where it lies for them is in the kind of toxic relationships in the workplace where somebody's exploiting them or harassing them or bullying them, right? So that's what they talk about. And the way we do it in our research is we ask about positive and negative emotions, right? We ask them, tell me about, you know, some powerful positive emotions you experience. And then they talk about beauty. We ask about powerful negative emotions. They talk about what we're calling ugliness, which is this kind of relational toxicity. So. God. So I think, yeah, like, I mean, if you could talk about beauty as, say, justice, right? And you see relationships that are just and harmonious, or even, you know, in society, we see a lot of injustice that we'd call ugly, and we would denounce it, and we say, that's not beautiful, like the way people are being treated, or you know, how certain structures are. But usually underlying those judgments of, you know, you want to denounce some kind of unjust structure, you're assuming that there is a kind of opposite of that, which is the just kind of order, the way things ought to be, and that's a vision of something beautiful.
Gotcha.
So I kind of, you know, if you ask me, I mean, I'm it's hard for me to separate my own judgments from what I do as a researcher, and I'm always like, in what field do you mean? I mean, do you mean for a lawyer, or do you mean for a scientist, or, you know, so I don't know if I have my own, like,
But see, I think, like, certain words like ugliness will never have any type of positive feedback. So I think it's different to say, this is something that I'm attracted to versus this is something that I'm not attracted to.
This
is something that I find appealing. This is something that I don't find appealing. Because then I'm not, because I don't find it attractive doesn't mean it's not attractive.
Correct.
But when you, not you, but when someone describes something as ugly, no one wants to see that as beautiful, because you've determined that it's already this thing.
I think that's just that. You're setting the boundaries between what's beautiful and what's the opposite, right? And because I think there's a lot of things that, you know, some, you know, like you can say, like, look, this piece of music or this piece of art is beautiful, I just don't like it, but I can see the beauty, I can see how other people find it beautiful because it has symmetry or has these kinds of, you know, harmonies or whatever, right? And you can say that's great, it's just not for me, you know, and that's fine,
right? And by the same token, you've always hear people say, I don't see what's so special about this person,
right?
You know? So it doesn't mean they don't think the person isn't attractive, they just don't see what the hype is about.
Right.
I love when a person can use their resources and tools to sell anything. It's a lesson in marketing. And it's great. It's a science. And some people are masters of it. Like, and I think the best to do it in the game, you know, are the Kardashians. You know, they're masters of it. And so I find that quite impressive, where others sometimes don't want to see people constantly win. You know, of course, they have their shares of troubles and things like that. But sometimes when a person is winning constantly, then it automatically builds up resentment. And then it's not beautiful to that person anymore. And that's unfortunate.
Yeah, that's fantastic. No, thank you. I mean, I think it's a very generative term, and it has a lot of, opens up a lot of different ways of looking at the world. I think if you look at it through the lens of beauty, and it doesn't mean the same thing to everybody, but I do think there are certain common features. There may be, you know, maybe 11 to 25 different sort of things that we could consider beautiful. I don't think it's an infinite range of things.
Right.
But because there's so much diversity in the things we find beautiful, I think it's possible to have some interesting conversations. But also, I think it can help people. My sense is it can help people to thrive, right? If you pay attention to what's beautiful in your work, you know, try to look for that and try to work in a way that's beautiful, or to find beauty in your work. And it's not just one thing. It can be a range of things,
right?
But you pursue those and it can, you know, help you to flourish and thrive in better ways.
Just the world in itself. There's a series on Netflix called like the Planet series or something like that. And it's beautiful to see how things have, I dare say the word evolve because I believe in design, but however the process is, you know, you say, you know, there was an explosion versus someone say, let there be light. You know, the explosion still happened, the light still happened. So to decide which path you want to go spiritually. But it is when you see the wonder of the world and the beauty and the complexity of just how things are, from the simplest things, the ocean and animal life and butterflies, it's breathtakingly beautiful. And just how things work, from a bumblebee moving pollen from this plant to this plant, and how plants respond to this type of organism. And whatever. It's just, I find it to be the most fascinating thing.
And then
some of the colors I wish I could duplicate, you know, in fabric. Now there's a silk dyeing process that you can, that's kind of tedious, but it's beautiful. You know, it's really beautiful. Some of the just naturally occurring colors in nature are just beautiful. And I'm in awe of it. So.
Yeah. Well, I think that's one of the power of beauty is it makes us want to reproduce it, right? Like you encounter those colors and you're like, I want to be able to create that and to share that with others, right? So I think it also, you know, my latest podcast episode, my guest talked about how you defined it was beauty as a shy peek at divinity, right? It's a kind of, there's something beyond breaking through that, you know, there can be things that you find pretty, but they're also really powerful experience of beauty that are kind of almost otherworldly and pull you out of yourself and point to something beyond, which is, you know, I think also part of the arresting power of beauty.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
Yeah, wonderful. Ian, thank you. I'm very grateful for you being on the show.
Thank you.
Hey everyone, thanks for listening to this episode of Beauty at Work. Please be sure to check out our show notes for more resources from our guest. And if you like this episode, please be sure to share it with your friends. And please leave us an honest review. We'd love to hear what you think, and it helps to get the word out about our show. Music edited by Venkat Subramaniam, and the podcast was edited by Dave Visaya from Podcast Engineers. And thanks again to our two sponsors, Templeton Religion Trust and the Institute for Advanced Catholic Studies at the University of Southern California. For a research project on beauty and science, visit wellbeingandscience.com. To learn more about our broader project on beauty at work, visit beautyatwork.net. Thanks again, and see you next time.